Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Clones, what's up? Welcome to our daily jungle, or should I say, welcome to the funeral of Dr. Dave in Chicago, because I had a huge show lined up for you, takes for days, and then Dave hops on the phone and tries to take a shot back at Broadway Vic, and it went about as well as you might have expected. So while I had three excellent guests, Texas Tech basketball coach Chris Beard, SI's Tom Verducci, and New Orleans Pelicans coach Alvin Gentry, it was hard enough that we were putting aim down. We had to dig a second hole for the doctor. Alvy, put down your shovel because the Daily Jungle starts right now. When somebody gets a beat down verbally like that on the phones, it's only fair that I put aside what it is I want to talk about and give them a chance to respond. So Vic just said, hey, if you got a problem with this, Dave, step up. Lob us a phone call. Grab the vine, which is what he's doing right now. So we go to Chicago. Dr. Dave, I'm putting aside what I was going to go right to the phones. Hey, Dave, what's going on? How are you? Go ahead, Doc. You're on the air.
Jim, how's it going?
Good, good. What's up?
Hey, Jim, how's it going?
Still good. What's up?
Hey, hope you, not much, man. Hope you and Alvy got your flu shots and got awarded the best new jungle scope out there, the wood scope. But first, I must say a somber yippee-ki-yay to the death of the original Mr. Falcon, Tommy Novus. Even Tom Rothman can appreciate that. And God love that the podcast recently have been awesome. Gary Vee's a guy I'd run through the wall for. You got to get him to update some stuff in the show. He can improve a lot of stuff in the jungle, such as your call screen software or maybe Vic's smack-off game. Sorry for the late response, Vic, but unlike you, my position in this world has something of substantial community value. While you spend your time perfecting the perfect selfie, I spend my day recovering, saving dying children. Oh, sorry, Jim. I'm done.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Hey, my man, stay down. Stay down. Stay down, Doc. Stay down. Stop trying to get up. Stay down. Just stay down and play dead. Stay down. How much time did you spend writing that telephone call? How much time did you spend working that script? How hyped up did you get to come in here and respond to him? And then how badly did that go for you? That could not have gone any worse, Dave. That could not have gone any worse. If I were you, the first thing I would do is delete the Twitter app from your phone. In fact, I would eliminate all social media from your life. This is going to go so badly for you, I can't even begin to talk about it. That was a terrible decision. Hey, look, I'm not saying that if a guy walks right up and punches you in the face, that you just take a knee. But when that guy walked right up to you and punched you in the face, you should have just taken a knee and then stayed down and then fake like you were dead and hope that the whole world walked away. That literally could not have gone any worse. This is why you don't want to mess with that guy. If you don't know that kind of game, you don't do it. Art of war, Dave. Art of war. If you can't win that fight, don't even engage. Just keep moving. Let's see. I'm looking around for CBS's treatment. There it is. Hey, fellas, put that back up again in New York. I'm talking to my friends in New York. They had a graphic up underneath me on TV that said, Dr. Dave, delete your account. I like this. All right, so here's what's going on. We're giving up a little bit of control. This reminds me of a story I want to tell you really quickly. But I have monitors here, and the monitors are split like six different ways. So the guys back in New York are trying to learn the show and learn what I do and my cadence, and they're getting it, man. The learning curve is good. They had a graphic up on the screen that said, Dr. Dave, delete your account. That's awesome. That reminds me of way, way, way back in the day when I hosted Talk 2 on ESPN2. And we had in-studio guests, and I had Brady Anderson on. Remember Brady Anderson? Baltimore Orioles player, 50 home run guy, tremendous defensive player, great athlete, great speed. My man went to UC Irvine of all places. So Brady and I are on the set, and I'm doing this interview with him, and the guy's really bright, very, very bright. But I see him kind of craning his neck, and he's looking around. And literally during the interview, I said, Brady, what are you doing? What are you looking at? What are you looking for? Is there something you need? Can I help you? He said, no, I'm good. I said, then why are you doing that? What are you stretching out to see? He said, I'm looking at your monitor. I see how you've done other guests graphically. I want to know what you're saying about me right now. That's you, Dr. Dave. Dr. Dave's looking around the CBS Sports Network trying to figure out what the guys in New York are doing to him. What they're doing to you is putting up graphically, delete your account, Dave. I like it. I like it. That was a bad idea, wasn't it? So, Alvy, just walk this thing back. Go back to Vic very quickly. Vic came in here, and this is what Vic is known for. Vic is known for killing guys. Cracking skulls. So Vic's just doing what he does. I guess he's bored one day and feels like, you know, I think I'll make a little jungle run. I think I'll swing in and kill a few fools. Take a few guys down. Which is exactly what he did. And one of the guys he had in his crosshairs was Dr. Dave, pediatrician in Chicago.
I mean, what kind of quacks are the Colts sending their franchise quarterback to, man? I mean, what, did they send him to that idiot Dr. Dave in Chicago? Dr. Dave, a supposed pediatrician who can't even make it through one phone call to a radio show. Dude, I would never send my kids to Dr. Dave. I'd send my kids to Dr. Dre before I ever sent them to Dr. Dave. I'd send my kids to Dr. Kevorkian before I ever sent them to Dr. Dave. And Dave, if you have a problem with this, then grab a vine and step on up and get your head cracked.
It's like Vic knew. It's like Vic knew. Think of what he said in that phone call. This is a pediatrician who can't even get through a phone call. So if you've got a problem with it, step right up and get your head cracked. Because he knew that he would step right up. Back call and got his head cracked.
Sorry for the late response, Vic, but unlike you, my position in this world has something of substantial community value. While you spend your time perfecting the perfect selfie, I spend my day recovering, saving dying children. Oh, sorry, Jim. I'm done.
No. Man, that was so much better the second time I heard that. While you spend your day perfecting a selfie, I save my day, or I spend my day saving dying children. I mean, bro, I hope. But how can I trust you to save any sick child, much less a dying child, if you can't get through a phone call to a sports talk radio program? I haven't heard a guy choke up like that since Bodie. Except when Bodie did it, it won him a flat screen. It was awesome. Let's see the Twitter response, starting with PC Brent 1. He tweets, worst doctor ever. At Randall in the OC tweets, Dr. Flame. At Trader Brent tweets, I believe that Dr. Dave in Chicago literally choked. Cough, hack, gag.
Oh, sorry, Jim.
At Steve, PHX tweets, Dr. Dave wrote his phone call but couldn't read his own writing. Aaron in Diamond Head tweets, could you imagine him explaining to parents what a kid has been diagnosed with? I'm sorry, folks. I have bad news. I'm very sorry. Doc, what is it? What is it? What does little Johnny have? I'm very sorry, folks. Doc, what is it? What's with Johnny? Is he going to be all right? Folks. I'm sorry. I'm out of here.
I'm done.
Wait, no, Doc. What does our child have? I'm sorry. I'm done. Is it lupus? Is it polio? I'm sorry. I'm done.
Sorry, Jim.
At Kevin the D tweets, sounds like Dr. Dave should stick to wiping snotty noses and handing out charity lollipops. It's not going well for you, Dave. Delete your account. Delete all your accounts. Delete your social.
Perfecting the perfect selfie. I spend my day recovering, saving dying children. sorry, Jim.
Rome, listening to Dr. Flame was like watching an ambulance drive off a cliff. Total flatline. Peter and PDX. Well, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is, Dave, I've got an interview right now. So that's going to buy you a little bit of space, a little bit of time. Bad news is that will live on forever. In infamy, that's never going away. You became that guy. Clones, can you give me just one moment so I can talk to you about stamps.com? Listen, these days, you can get practically everything on demand, such as our podcast. Listen whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. So let me ask you, why are you still going to the post office and dealing with their limited hours when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? Anything that you can do at the post office, you can now do right from your desk. As an example, the holidays are coming up. My wife, Janet, is all about the Christmas card. We send out hundreds, literally hundreds of Christmas cards, and there's no way we could do it without Stamps.com. I'm going to print my own postage. I'm going to do it when I want and do it at home. Trust me, with the holidays coming up, you should do the exact same thing, and you'll thank me for it. Go to Stamps.com, hit the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Jungle. That's Stamps.com. Enter Jungle for a special, special offer. A four-week trial, which includes postage and a digital scale. Do not wait. You want to go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, hit the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Jungle. That's Stamps.com. Enter Jungle. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office ever again. I know I won't. That's Stamps.com. Now it's back to our Daily Jungle. Chris Beard is my guest. Chris, nice to have you back on the show. How are you?
Jim, I'm doing great. Great to be on.
It's good to have you back on, Chris. Let me ask you about that win over Kennesaw State last night, 82-53. I bring that up because that was the program's first win as a ranked team in 8 years. Now, for a lot of programs and a lot of coaches, that might feel like a significant moment. Does it feel like that to you, or are you looking to get to the point with the program where that's not even something that you want to have brought up or have something like that come up?
I mean, a little bit of both. You know, we tell the guys, you know, we don't need to be talking about getting ranked. We need to talk about, you know, staying ranked. And we don't need to be talking about getting in the tournament. We need to be talking about making a run in the tournament. But probably a little bit of coaching cliche in that. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, when you get yourself ranked in the top 25, it's a good thing, not only for your team, but your program, but your university. So last night was a game we had kind of targeted to kind of validate our success. We got ranked a couple weeks ago, and then we lost our next game to Seton Hall and fell out of the rankings. So this was our second chance to kind of validate. So that was kind of the theme of last night's win.
Texas Tech head coach Chris Beard, my guest. Now, there was a moment in the first half that went viral where Zach Smith dropped a windmill dunk. I know you're more focused on the performance of the team as a whole, but you've also talked about wanting him to be as aggressive as possible on the offensive end. So what was your reaction when you saw him throw that down?
That's just good coaching, Jim. That's what that is, man. We work right on those dunks every day.
I know it.
No, just kidding. But we got two incredible athletes on our team, Zach Smith and Zaire Smith. Something runs in that name. When we're out recruiting, that's the first thing we look for is your name Smith? We'll take you.
There you go.
But no, those guys are special athletes. And, you know, I used to work for Coach Knight, as you know, and Coach would always talk about, you know, a dunk is just 2 points. But that's one of the few things that I kind of respectfully disagree with Coach on. I think the dunk in college basketball, whether you like it or not, is basically worth more than 2 points because it kind of gets your team going, it gets your crowd going. It's just something to that play in our game. So we're fortunate this year with a couple of great athletes where we can make some plays above the rim, and it seems to, you know, help our team get going.
Yeah, I really agree with you on that. I think it is worth more than 2 points, especially when it's that guy and you're on him to be more aggressive, and then he throws one down like that, and it did go viral. Now, you smashed number 20 Northwestern. You beat number 22 Nevada. Early in the season, sure, there's always a balance to be struck between trying to make too much or too little out of a win like that, or wins, but how important are they when you're trying to develop a culture in a program?
Yeah, that's exactly right. They're big because it's basically just kind of validating our process. You know, like whenever you're building a program, you're basically telling the guys, you know, things, but it's kind of based on a dream. It's based on words because we really don't have a body of work to back it up. But whenever you can have some of these early season successes, whether it be beating a good team like Northwestern or, you know, even getting on SportsCenter and things like that, all these things matter because they validate that what we're doing, what we believe in, works.
You know, when you and I talked during the tournament back in 2016, when you had led Little Rock to the NCAA tournament, we talked about your journey and the fact that you had coached in places like Fort Scott Community College, Seminole State. Knowing that journey, what's it feel like to be back at Texas Tech and as the head coach?
It's just awesome, man. I it just means the world to me. I feel like in coaching that I represent a lot of people other than myself. You know, I think there's a lot of great coaches at the different levels, whether it be in junior college or Division II, I'm really proud of my path. You know, I'm like, we were talking to guys the other day about just kind of embracing who you are. and not trying to be somebody you're not. Like, you know, my deal is I've always kind of been like the street dog, you know, and kind of always taken the hard way and tried to prove people wrong and never really been given anything to me. And then, you know, there's a lot of, you know, like pet store dogs. I remember as a kid, you know, we'd go to the mall on Saturdays and we'd go in a pet store in the mall and I'd look at those dogs, but I never thought about buying one of them because I'm more of a Humane Society kind of guy. So it's kind of like that with this team. It's why I'm having so much fun and why we're off to a good start. We've got, you know, street dogs in this team. We don't have any McDonald's All-Americans. We don't have guys that have come up the easy way. We've got guys that have to kind of work for everything they've got. And that really, you know, is the same thing with West Texas, being out here at Texas Tech in Lubbock. It's just been a great fit for me. I'm honored and privileged to be the coach here.
Chris Beard joining us. You know, I wonder about that because, I mean, you're one of those street dogs. You wake up every single day with an edge. You've talked about that yourself. But when you've been a conference coach of the year, you're coaching in the Big 12, you're ranked right now. Is there any part of you that thinks, I have arrived, or do you still wake up every single day with that same edge and that same feeling that, look, guys like me only get one chance?
No, no way. I mean, I haven't arrived. Hell, I went to get breakfast this morning, and you'd figure getting ranked and all this, I ordered a breakfast burrito, and I asked for salsa, and the guy's like, hey, man, that'll be 50 cents extra. So, you know, I haven't arrived. Every day I try to get up and just kind of validate yesterday and look forward to tomorrow. But the cool thing this year with this team at Texas Tech is our players kind of have that same mold. Like, we got a lot going on in the program right now, but when I got to work this morning, there's already four players in the gym getting shots up. So I'm just really enjoying coaching this team because they kind of fit my personality, and I would hope that the players would say the same about mine.
We're talking to Texas Tech head coach Chris Beard. You know, some of the spots on the journey are pretty amazing, and you said that one of the best was when you were a graduate assistant at Incarnate back in 1995. What do you remember about that job, and what made that stop so special?
Just the first job, you know, is always your best. I felt like I was sitting next to Coach K at Duke when I was at Incarnate Word, just, you know, excited to get up every day and just coach college basketball. I really feel that way today as well. You know, I mean, coaches always say this. It's not really a job. It's a lifestyle. You know, I would do this for free. You know, I hope my AD, Kirby Hocutt's not listening because I don't want him to know that. But I've never really considered coaching a job. It's just a privilege to coach, especially at this level with these players. But every journey I've had was always the best job I've ever had, and I feel like that today as well.
Now, one of the mantras of that program was 4-1. 4-1. Lay that out for me. What is the significance of that? What does that mean, 4-1?
Well, to me, mental toughness is everything. You know, we tell our guys the mental is to the physical is 4-1. And I really believe that. You know, I believe in college basketball, everybody has good players. Nobody on our roster doesn't have, or on our schedule doesn't have good players. There's pros. Just look at the NBA draft. You know, all the players don't just come from BCS schools. They come from all over the world. So everybody has talent. But what I think what separates the average teams from the good and maybe the good from even the great is just the ability to do it over time and be consistent. And to me, that's all about mental toughness. You got to be mentally tough, obviously, when you're going through adversity, but you've also got to be mentally tough when you have some success, like we're having now, you know, to come back to work the next day. But 4-1 means everything to us. It's just our symbol for mental toughness.
You know, what about that? I mean, is that something you coach? Is that something you teach? Or basically, can you only recruit that? In other words, if they're soft when they get there, can you make them mentally tough?
You know, maybe. At the end of the day, we're in the business of talent. You know, I think all coaches will probably tell you they like to recruit tough people and all that. But the bottom line is, you know, if there's some guy that can jump out of the gym and stroke it, and he might not be the toughest guy, you're still going to try to get him based on talent. So above all, it's a talent business. But then I think we all kind of try to recruit to our identities. Obviously, you better be able to rebound the basketball to play for Coach Izzo, or you better be athletic to play for Shaka. And I think with us, that is one of the things that we value. You got to be a tough guy. Like, we call a high school coach or an AAU coach or a junior college coach, if we hear the word soft, I mean, we run pretty quick. So it starts with just an understanding of trying to recruit tough people. Then absolutely, I think you can develop that. Just the day-to-day grind, telling the truth, putting it out there in front of them, you know, keeping guys motivated. You know, to me, that's all goes into coaching.
We're talking to Texas Tech head basketball coach Chris Beard. Saturday, you've got Rice, which means you've got a throwback night too. How far are you throwing it back, and what's it mean in terms of the uniform and especially the shorts? Are you going to break out the short shorts?
We are, man. I wish you could be here. It's going to be a pretty cool deal. We we've got great basketball tradition at Texas Tech, which a lot of people maybe on the national scene might not know, but there was the day back in the days in the 50s and 60s and 70s where you'd have to stand in line for a day to get a ticket, and our old Coliseum still exists on our campus, so we've kicked off the dust, man. We bought an old floor this summer and refurbished it. It's going to be great, man. We got no electronic boards in there. It's going to be like old school, like 1950. We are bringing back the short shorts, you know. I told the guys they need to go ahead and go get them some spandex because they're going to need them. It's going to be a great day. I went in our locker room this morning over there. It's like a dungeon, man. It's like concrete floors. It's going to be a street dog day for us. It's going to be great.
Chris Beard, my guest. Before I let you go, a couple of quick things. You mentioned Bob Knight. I would imagine you've got a million Bob Knight stories. Is there a good story, a favorite story that you can tell on air?
Absolutely. You know, the thing with Coach was he did so many things behind the scenes for great people. Everybody kind of knows the Bob Knight where the camera was in his face during competition, but they don't maybe give him enough credit for everything he did off the court. But I remember my first year I was with him, I was just amazed on how many former players came back in town. And I know for a fact, Coach would kick my ass for saying this, but at this point I don't care because I love him so much. But he would do so many things for people, whether it be his former players would get in a jam and he'd help them out financially or making calls to people when they were kind of down on their luck. And, you know, I'd put Pat in the same category. Pat was also just one of the best people you ever met. And that's kind of one of the things with Coach that people don't understand, that I think I take my responsibility to kind of tell people the truth about Coach seriously because he's a great human being.
Chris Beard, my guest. You know, Chris, also, when you were in Little Rock, there was not a Whataburger for miles. How is it to be back in the land of Whataburger?
It's great, man, especially the late night, you know, coaching hours when you get back in town. Whataburger's open 24/7. I do get a little respect there. You know, no respect this morning with the salsa, but I actually went into Whataburger the other day. We got back from a road trip real late, and I was in there about 2:30. And you know what a Whataburger is like at 2:30, and that's all the people coming from the bars. And I actually was in the drive-thru, and the manager, I guess, saw my car and came out and gave me a little curbside service. So I do get a little respect from Whataburger, which is much appreciated.
Is that the best thing? I mean, you're right. When guys are spilling out of the bars at 2:30 in the morning, we all have our go-to thing. Like, I'm a SoCal guy, so I'm more of an In-N-Out guy. I went to Lexington once. My guy Rex Chapman hit me up with a White Castle, which I'd never done in the middle of the night. You sound like a Whataburger. Is that your go-to, or is there something else that's on par in the middle of the night after maybe having a pop? Maybe a pop.
You know, the good IHOP, man, the 2 a.m. IHOP's always a good one, too. Kind of get the corner booth and just kind of people watch. Yeah, but the combination between IHOP and Whataburger are my go-to late nights.
If you don't know this yet, Joel Embiid is a superstar. That's a fact. That is not up for debate. This guy is a superstar. Now, I know it's borderline insane to say that about a guy who's only 53 games into his career, but it's the truth. And I'm not saying it because he's a seven-footer who can hit threes and drop Euro steps. Or the numbers that he puts up, which are insane, like 28, 12, and 8 that he had against Minnesota on Tuesday night, including 11 in the fourth quarter and overtime. All of those are great, but that's not why I'm saying that he's a superstar. He's a superstar because the Sixers did not play Wednesday, and I'm leading the show talking about him on a Thursday. And because his social media game is just as good, if not better, than his basketball game, and that's saying something. As an example, last night, he posted a pic of himself against the T-Wolves with Karl-Anthony Towns in the background, and the caption read, and I quote, "Euro-stepping our way through Minnesota, and we ended up raising the cat last night. Hashtag the process." Towns saw it, didn't like it, fired right back in the comments with a strong line of his own. Quote, "That caption was as trash as your picture quality." End quote. I mean, that's strong. That's returning fire that's strong. Except that was his big mistake. That was KAT's big mistake. Because as good as that line was, you're only entering the ring against Tyson in his prime. And Joel went for the knockout. And I quote, "better quality than your defense." Bam! And that, friends, is why Joel Embiid is Joel Embiid and everybody else is not. He just invited KAT into the ring, and he turned the lights out with a single punch. He raised the cat and then knocked him out. And like any great genius, from the moment he posted that pic, you knew it happened. But when it did, it was even better than I expected. And don't think for a second that the process doesn't know how the process works. He knows he's a hero right now, but eventually people are going to turn on him and he'll be a villain. He knows it. He gets it. He told ESPN, quote, "People love you at the beginning, but at some point they're going to start hating you. LeBron, Russell Westbrook, all the superstars, even Steph. He's so likable, he does nothing wrong, but some people still hate him. It just comes with the nature of it. I've seen it. I feel like I'm about to go through it. I think it's coming. People always want something new," end quote. Man, this dude gets it. I mean, this dude, he not only has a ton of it, he gets it. He knows how it works. The process understands the process. He has seen this movie before. He's actually lived it. But let me say this. Let me say this, Joel. If people start turning on you and they start hating you, I will fight them. Because anybody who hates you hates themselves. You can't like basketball and not love Joel Embiid. Check that. You can't like life and not love Joel Embiid. There are a ton of guys who have game on the court. There are a few guys who have game on social media. But nobody's got Embiid's combination of game on the court and on social media. His basketball ability is up there with anybody who has ever laced up. And his Twitter skills are up there with anybody who's ever logged on. I mean, I'm starting to wonder how I was able to enjoy the NBA without Embiid in it. How I was able to use social media before he got there. And now that I've seen him on both, I don't want to imagine either one without Joel, Hans, Embiid. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Keeping this cat healthy is a national priority. Keeping Joel Embiid on the court is the second most important thing in the world right now. Second only to keeping a phone in his hand, because that's the single most important thing in the world right now. You might think, damn, Rome, what is your deal? Where are you going with this? Where are you going with this? I'll tell you exactly where I'm going with this. I don't play favorites. Ever. Ever. Never have, never will. But I will admit this. I'll even own this. I love Joel Embiid. And if you want to hate this guy, go ahead and hate me too. Because I love Joel Embiid. And no, I don't play favorites. I don't play favorites, but Joel Embiid might be my favorite athlete. He might be my favorite human being. Reminds me of way back in the day when I got my start in this business, on my way up in this business. My favorite dude to talk about and talk to was Terrell Buckley, somebody I referenced in passing yesterday. But back in the day, man, that was my dude, T-Buck. I love T-Buck. The clones knew I loved T-Buck. One day this clone runs into Terrell Buckley on a golf course or an event and says to him, "Man, what is Rome's deal with you? He's always hyping you." To which T-Buck replied, and I quote, "I don't know, man. He just loves me. I don't know, man. He just loves me." Right. Just like I love Embiid. This dude is a once-in-a-generation player and personality. And I'll say it again. If you hate him, it's because you hate yourself. My guest is Tom Verducci. Tom, it's great to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jim. I'm just trying to recover from an exciting winter meeting watching teams make a run at nameless, faceless middle relievers.
Good times. It's so great. Well, what about that? I mean, the winter meetings are underway, but it feels like the offseason truly got underway before the winter meetings. You've got a piece on SI.com breaking down how the Angels and the Yankees ended up with Ohtani and Stanton. Before we get into that, how important is it, though, for baseball, Tom, to be getting the kind of run and buzz that it is in December?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I called Ohtani and Giancarlo Stanton the two most dramatic, compelling, available players on the planet. You know, I'm taking Mike Trout and Bryce Harper out of the equation, but in terms of availability, yeah, I mean, you're coming off now two straight years where you had exciting seven-game World Series, ratings are up, local ratings are terrific, but to carry that through the offseason, to me, you need marquee names, and those are two pretty good ones right there, and Ohtani because he's that rare two-way player, and Stanton because he's a 6'6" beast who hit 59 dingers last year and he's putting on pinstripes. So it's off to a good start in terms of the marquee value.
Tom Verducci joining us. All right, so what about Ohtani in terms of his arrival with the Angels? What's it mean to the franchise both on and off the field?
Well, on the field, it's huge because there's been a lot of talk the last couple of years that they are wasting the best years of the best player in baseball. That's Mike Trout, obviously. He's got three more years to go before he can leave. In the last few years, actually, last year was decent, but still a mediocre kind of vanilla franchise without a lot to be excited about and a terrible farm system. So there wasn't any indication this team was going to turn around quickly. Ohtani really changed that equation overnight. I think he's that good as a starting pitcher. I think he can beat Jacob DeGrom, be an impact-type guy immediately in the big leagues. The fact that he can be an all-star hitter, I don't think he will be off the bat, Jim, because I think it's just too hard physically to do both. And if you're going to compromise, I would not compromise what he can do on the mound. He's a better pitcher than hitter right now. But just the energy he creates by, A, being a great pitcher, and, B, trying to do something really nobody has done successfully since Babe Ruth to be a two-way player, that's a jolt of excitement. And then they went out and they got Ian Kinsler last night to play second base. That's going to help. Don't forget they re-signed Justin Upton a month ago. Now all of a sudden they're in the mix for a wild card in the American League. So on the field, yeah, arrow is pointing up. And off the field as well, I think Ohtani is going to be a draw. There's no doubt about it. I can't wait for that first series between the Yankees and the Angels. And I hope Ohtani gets to pitch to Stanton.
Yeah, that's going to be great. It'll be tremendous. Tom Verducci joining us. Now, as you wrote, there were 27 teams that were in pursuit of Ohtani, and quote, sources from two of the teams say the report included a notation that Ohtani underwent a platelet-rich plasma injection on the right elbow in October, end quote. Now, Tom, when that came out, Angel fans started freaking out that they had signed a guy with a bad arm. First off, what is a PRP injection, and what's it say about his elbow?
It's a platelet-rich plasma injection. Basically, it takes the blood out of your body and spins it in a centrifuge to basically take the real good healing stuff, the plasma, platelet-rich plasma, away from the rest of it, and then puts it back into the elbow. And your elbow, if you've had inflammation, irritation, in some cases a small tear, it will help in the healing process. Now, I have never personally heard of it being used as a preventative measure. To me, it's always been a procedure to heal some sort of injury or irritation. But the agent for Ohtani says, listen, this is what they do in Japan. They use it as a preventative measure. I'm still not buying that, to be honest with you. I'm not sure clubs did as well. But here's the way clubs look at it, Jim. They don't see it as something major right now. It's sort of like a stud pitcher coming out of college who's in the draft. There may be an issue with the arm. Maybe at some point he's going to need surgery. You're not going to back off him because he's so young and at this point in his career so cheap. And that's the case for Ohtani. You know, I had one general manager tell me, listen, there's a possibility, probability actually, in the next 6 years, he'll probably need some procedure on that elbow. But the cost is so low, the upside is so high. As he stands right now today, health-wise, he's good to go. So, yeah, it's a risk, but that was not a risk that stopped anybody from getting in the game because they were above board, the agent was, with the team. Here's what it is, and they gave him a full workup physical in Southern California to pass that around to the team. So it wasn't a stopper in terms of a health risk.
You know, I get all that, Tom. I agree with all that. And I'm with you. I don't see, and what do I know? That does not sound preventative to me. I know guys who've done it. I know guys who think that it works. But they've all done it for a reason. That to me does not sound like preventative maintenance. But to your point, he's a young guy. And given what they've signed him for, it's worth the risk. All right, so now what about Stanton? You've got the trade of Stanton to New York. And with the addition of Stanton, as you've pointed out, the Yankees now have sluggers who rank second, third, and fourth all time in terms of home runs at their points in their career. How lethal then is that lineup going to be?
I mean, two things, Jim. This is, first of all, a modern day murderer's row. You know, in any era, this would be a must watch lineup. But now you're talking about since the second half of 2015, they've gotten to that livelier baseball. I don't care what they say, it is livelier. Mm-hmm. It's just crazy to think what these guys can do with this baseball, with their size, and with Yankee Stadium as a home park, where to me, it's not so much how far they hit it. It's when they don't hit it well. When you hit it the other way at Yankee Stadium as a right-handed hitter, it can still go out of the yard. So it's crazy to me the damage they can do. And I call it leveraging how the game is played today with home runs. The Yankees led the majors in home runs last year. And they'll leverage the baseball and the way the game is played, such a power game now, better than anybody else. Now, outside of those kind of dynamics of how the game is played on the field, This is going to be like Michael Jordan's Bulls, you know, back to the 60s with the Beatles traveling around. That's what the Yankees are going to be in baseball terms. They're must-watch. They're must-watch at 5 o'clock for batting practice. You know, teams should open up their park on the road early to watch people watch these guys hit. Stanton, Judge, Sanchez, Greg Bird can hit him a mile. People don't even mention him. So I think, listen, they're the Yankees, so they're already the most compelling team because you either love them or you hate them. I get that. But now because of just the sheer power and physicality of these guys, yeah, they're a traveling rock show right now.
Tom Verducci joining us for a few more moments. That's extremely well said. Tom, what about one of the all-time great Yankees, Derek Jeter, taking all sorts of heat for how he's handled things in the offseason? As an example, what do you make of what he received in value for Stanton and then for Marcell Ozuna?
Personally, I didn't love it. I understand there's a sliding scale where when you're moving a huge contract, the more money you pass along with the deal, the better prospects you get back. You can't really have it both ways where someone takes all the money and they give you great prospects. I thought the Marlins should have prioritized the talent coming back more than they did the money that the Yankees were picking up. I mean, the Yankees won this trade because they were willing to pick up more money than anybody else. It's great. So to me, the Marlins were driven more by just pure salary dump than they were, let's get some guys we can show our fans here the next year or two. I would have done it differently, but that's the roadmap. I get it. That's a choice they made. Now, listen, I also had a problem with them saying that Stanton could have stayed. No, there's no way he could have stayed. This is a team that wanted to strip the payroll down to $90 million. I get that. You know, to me, I would have thought if you're going to strip it down, you got to go all the way. You know, the Cubs did that. The Astros did that. They paid for it for 3-4 years. But that's the right way to rebuild. Okay, you're bringing it down to 90. You can't have Stanton making $30 million. And it just doesn't work. I mean, you can't have it both ways. So once they made the decision about payrolls, Stanton, to me, did not have the option of staying there. It just was not workable for him, for the team. I would say that, like the Cubs and the Astros, the Marlins should have been, and this includes Bruce Sherman, the owner. I mean, let's not give him a pass either. You have to be more transparent when you're doing something that's as painful as a rebuild, you know? And that's what the Cubs and the Astros did. They let people know, here's our plan. You know, basically, we're going to be really bad the next couple of years. Hang in there. But every trade we make, we're going to make sure we're going to put a competitive team on the field that's going to be sustainable. I haven't heard the Marlins articulate that game plan. They really need to do that to a fan base that, let's face it, they've been burned so many times there, they just don't trust whoever is owning the team.
Tom Verducci, my guest. You know, Tom, one last stop before you go. One of the nuggets that you reported earlier this week was that the Astros knew that Yu Darvish was tipping his pitches in the World Series. What did they see, and then what did they know as a result of that?
Yeah, this is fascinating. Listen, everybody tries to, you know, get a tell from a pitcher, right? But the Astros, to me, they've always been, especially the last couple of years, as good as anybody at figuring those things out. And it used to be guys like Paul Molitor back in the day were great at it because they just trusted their eyes. Now these teams have so many different camera angles, things that you and I don't see at home. They can pick up anything if a pitcher does something a little bit flaky out there on the mound. And in Darvish's case, it's funny, he went to an all-stretch delivery. In other words, he doesn't pitch from a windup. He went to that to simplify his delivery a couple of years ago. And in this case, it actually hurt him because he would start with the baseball in his right hand, down by his hip, get the sign, and then bring the ball into his glove. And as he did that, as he brought the ball into his glove, he would either keep the same grip or he would re-grip. So by doing that, seeing that little slight movement or lack of movement, the Astros knew whether he was throwing a slider or cutter or the fastball. And you look back on the World Series, I mean, he was bad. Let's be upfront about that. His slider just wasn't very good. But on top of that, if they knew it was coming, he had no chance. I mean, he threw 48 sliders in those two World Series starts. He got two swings and misses, and the Astros hit 556 against it. And this is a guy who's normally got one of the best sliders in the game. So that's why I say he's a free agent now. I dismiss the idea that now all of a sudden he's worth less because the Astros rocked him. But I make sure I had a pitching coach who worked with this guy to make sure he doesn't tip his pitches anymore.
It really is fascinating. One last thought as a follow then. If you're the Dodgers, Tom, and you're watching this, I mean, are you thinking this guy is not who we thought he was? Or are you thinking that slide piece is a really, really good pitch and they're not swinging and missing? He must be tipping it off. In other words, what was LA thinking as that was going on, and could they not adjust back? Obviously not, because they didn't, right?
Yeah, remember, too, that during the World Series, I was writing about how all the pitchers were complaining that the baseballs were slicker in the World Series. And Darvish was one of several pitchers, especially throwing sliders, who said, yes, the ball's slicker and I have trouble gripping it, especially on a breaking pitch. So I think it was easy to write off his troubles regarding the baseballs used in the World Series. I don't think it had anything to do with nerves or anything like that. And I think that was probably on the Dodgers' mind that, you know, hey, this is about the baseballs more than it is about tipping pitches. Or I don't even know if that was on their radar. It reminds me of Andy Pettit. If you remember Game 6 of the 2001 World Series.
Yep.
The D-backs had everything he threw from the stretch. I mean, he had a lot of runners on base, so that was a lot of pitches. The Yankees had no clue what was going on.
I'm a big R.E.M. fan. I love R.E.M. Or at least back in the day. I came up in college radio when R.E.M. first broke, so we played a lot of R.E.M. back in the day. Love the band. Michael Stipe once said, it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. Well, today is the end of AOL's Instant Messenger, and I feel, you know, really, I don't know how I feel. I don't know how I feel, because if we're quoting legends around here, I may as well borrow from another one. The extremely profound words of one Anthony Sawyer Horton Jr. I hate it, but I love it.
I hate it, but I love it.
If I'm governmenting my man Tony Horton, you know it's important. You know, he may have been talking about a home exercise program, but that's about as accurate a description of my feelings towards AIM as there's ever going to be. I hate it, but I love it.
I hate it, but I love it.
I mean, that app had one function, one job to execute, and like 80% of the time, it can't do it. I'm telling you, I've rebooted AIM no less than 5 times already today. No joke. It's as close to useless as possible. Actually, it's worse than useless because I sink so much time into giving this piece of garbage CPR every single morning. One thing for it not to work, but this app's got a way of pretending like it's going to do what it's supposed to do, and then it just dies on you over and over and over again. But if your next question is, great, Rome, there's a million other options. Why not use one of them? See, that's the thing. AIM is like a loyal dog. Hell, it's been a part of this show longer than Alvin. There's undeniable history here. And up until about 6 months ago, it was a pretty good employee. So I'm not going to pretend like there weren't some great years, because there were. But Father Time is undefeated. And Father Time is the only screen name left on AIM's buddy list. And like some kind of virus, Father Time has ravaged AIM and left it a pathetic version of what it used to be. So the plug pulling tomorrow cannot come soon enough. And to be charitable to me and my staff and everybody who uses it worldwide, and most of all to AIM itself, it's time to put that old girl down. Time to take her out back and do it humanely. So Alvin, with that in mind, could you please play AIM off into the afterlife? That's my eulogy. That's my eulogy. Thoughtful, respectful, honorable, nostalgic. There were some laughs, there were some tears. Mostly just anger and frustration. You're welcome to give yours, but remember, this is a funeral, not a pitch meeting. I know all about GChat and Slack and GoToMeeting, Google Docs, save it, and show some respect for an OG. In fact, one of my new staffers, a newer one of course, offered to switch me over to GChat earlier this week. Calloused bastard. I said I'm gonna ride with this thing until the very end. Let's just get to the end of Thursday with an old friend that deserves respect. So pour one out today for AOL Instant Messenger, the backbone of the jungle for many, many glorious years. Rest in peace to the greatest chat app ever. May 1997 through December 2017. What a run. God, we lost two of our own today, didn't we? Dr. Dave and AIM. Guys back in New York have had to go with 2 RIP graphics in one day. Who else is going to die on me? This is terrible. Yeah, Alvy. Hey, Alvin, what's your message to AIM? Time to die! Hey, so if you want to come with your thoughts or your own eulogy, or you want to talk about a screen name that was great back in the day, you go ahead and do it. 1-800-636-8686. It is toll free. You have your number. Hit me up. Let's go to Indiana. Fred. Hey, Fred, what's up? How are you?
Rome, good to talk to you, brother. I just came on to give my RIP to AIM.
Good thing, man. What are your thoughts?
I'll tell you what. I was late teens, early 20s in the late 90s, and it was the freaking wild, wild west of the internet. The chat rooms were an unbelievable place to hook up with girls. The member directory, are you freaking kidding me? You could just search girls your age or whatever age you were looking for. I was kind of prone to the 40-something married girls at the time, but that was just my thing. But you could search and be in the DMs right away. DMs are a huge deal on Twitter, and it takes a ton to get in there. You were in, like, Flynn right away, hooked up with tens of chicks. Not hundreds, not tens of tens, but tens of chicks anyway. But it will certainly be missed. I've long since been married with kids, but it was fun in the heyday, brother.
Mom, man, that is such a great call, Fred. Rack him. Good job, bro. Alvin Gentry is the head coach of the Pelicans. He is my guest. Alvin, so good to have you back. How are you?
All right. How you doing, Jim?
Doing great. Doing great. Nice to visit with you. Thanks for making time. You're coming off that win last night where DeMarcus Cousins had a putback dunk on a missed free throw by Jameer Nelson. He himself said afterwards, "I'm not your guy that's soaring above the rim, but the opportunity kind of presented itself, so I took advantage of it." So what did you make of the big fella getting up and throwing it down like that?
Well, you know, he has that ability. He's not going to be a guy that does it 10, 12 times a game or even two or three times a game, but I think the adrenaline was flowing at that particular point, knowing how important the game was, and it was a great putback by him.
Hey, listen, he had himself a night now. He had 26 points, he had 13 rebounds, he had 7 assists, and he had 9 turnovers. He owned that as well and said that last night proved how good that team can be if he's not turning the ball over. So how do you go about finding the right balance between having him spread the ball around but not turning it over?
Well, I think with him, most of his turnovers come on a little bit over aggressiveness. He's trying to take the ball and he's trying to get to maybe 2-3 people at a time. And I think he's really good at that when the ball is being swung and it come back to him. But all of it is done, Jim, out of the fact that he wants to win so badly that he's trying everything he can to help us win. So we've got to curb some of them, but for the most part, you know, they're aggressive turnovers. We just got to get that number, you know, to about half, you know.
Alvin Gentry joining us. So the Greek Freak had 32-9. He had 5 steals and 4 assists. And then Anthony Davis had 25-10 with 4 blocks. I mean, Alvin, we're talking about a couple of giant guys who can do just about everything on the court. You've been around this game a long, long time. What do you think when you see 7-footers like the two of them who are that versatile and that athletic?
Well, I think that's where our league is going. You know, you can take those guys and then you take a guy like Jokic, who we're going to play tomorrow night, and Carl Anthony Towns, and I think that's where the league is going. To be a big guy now, you almost have to be like the European players, you know, in the 90s and the early 2000s, where, you know, they could do it all. They could shoot jumpers, they could post up, they could pass the basketball, and I think that's the progression that you're seeing in our league with the big guys that are coming into the league now.
Now, it's going that way, but not everybody has one. You're fortunate that you do have a player like Davis, but if you don't have a big with that kind of quickness and that kind of versatility, how do you go about trying to stop a team that does have one?
I think it's really tough. And you know, like last night, Giannis, the improvement that he's made over a year and how he changed his body, you know, I told someone that he's basically – you know, he has the length of a Kevin Durant, but he's got shoulders like Dwight Howard. And so that's a crazy body type to be in this league. And, you know, he's playing at such a high level. You know, there's not anything that he can't do right now. Obviously, he's got to get a little better at his shot. But when you have a guy like that, it makes it a really, really tough matchup.
That's a great description. That he's got Durant's length, but he's got Dwight Howard's shoulders. You're right. I mean, it's an impossible matchup if you don't have somebody that. All right, so you're 29 games in, and the old saying goes that if the season were to end today, you'd be in the playoffs. Of course, the season does not end today, But that said, while you can't clinch a playoff spot in December, you could certainly blow a shot at one in December. So how are you feeling about where your team is right now?
You know, I feel pretty good about it. I still think that we've got a whole nother level that we can get to. So I'm going to continue to try to push buttons and get us there. You know, we've had AD out for 5 or 6 games. You know, so we've struggled a little bit when he's been out. But I think that when we're healthy and everybody is there, and I think the roles have been well-defined now, and we've got Drew Holiday and Etuan Moore playing at a real high level, and we've got two of the best big guys in the league. I think as long as that's the case and we're healthy, I think we've got a chance to be a special team.
Alvin Gentry, my guest. Plus, you added Jameer Nelson back in October. So what has he brought to the team in terms of a veteran presence and just a guy who knows how to play the game?
He really does know how to play the game. And it's interesting, Jim, because last night I was about to sub Rondo back in, and he said, you know what, this group is going pretty good. Let's leave him in and see what happens. And then, you know, in a minute or so, if it's not going good, I'll go in. And Jameer finished the game for us. Actually had a big steal. But, you know, he's just one of those guys. I mean, when you're a guy that small and you can last 15 years in this league, then you got to be a special player.
Alvin Gentry joining us. You know, I had Texas Tech head basketball coach Chris Beard on the show earlier, and I mentioned that because we were talking about the journey that he took from some very small schools and junior colleges to get to where he is right now. Everybody's journey is so different. When did you first start thinking about or realize that you wanted to coach at the highest level?
Well, I was a college coach, and I was an assistant with Larry Brown the year that we won the national championship in 1988 at Kansas. And he was talking about going to the NBA. I never felt like I wanted to be in the NBA. I thought I was always a college guy. So I said, you know, I'll go to the NBA for a couple of years. It looked good on the resume as far as trying to, you know, eventually get a head coaching job. And I came into the league and I really loved it because it was all basketball. I didn't have to worry about, you know, player X being at study table or player Z getting in a fight in a bar and it being my fault. So once I was in the NBA, I said, boy, this is the place I want to stay because I thought it was purely basketball.
Yeah, back in college, I couldn't wait to ask you about that. I mean, it's an amazing time for you and the rest of that staff. We're talking about staff for Larry Brown that included the likes of Greg Popovich, R.C. Buford, Bill Self, and more all in the same place. I mean, just saying that out loud sounds just crazy. Did that really happen? And if so, what was it like being a part of that group?
It was a great group, and, you know, as players, we had Kevin Pritchard, who's the director of basketball. We had Milton Newton, who was a GM in the NBA. So it was a real special group of guys, and it was a special situation. I mean, we went into the tournament 18-12, and we won 6 straight games and became national champs. So it's just getting hot at the right time. You know how that goes in college. You don't get to play, you know, 4 out of 7 or 3 out of 5. It's one and done. So we got hot at the right time, won 6 games, and was national champ.
Yeah, I mean, it's not always the best team. Sometimes it's the hottest team, or maybe it's both. But, I mean, it was a special time, but did you have any idea how special that time was when you were in the middle of it, or how much success everybody on that staff would go on to have?
I don't think anyone could have ever dreamed of everyone being so successful. Just so many guys, and, you know, obviously Greg Popovich and R.C. Buford, what they've done in San Antonio has been amazing. But, you know, what Kevin Pritchard, he's been in Portland and Indiana. And, you know, Milton Newton was in Washington and Minnesota. And, you know, you look at all the other guys that was on that staff, Bill Baino, what he's done. John Robick is the associate head coach at Kentucky. So there was a lot of good people on that staff that did a lot of good things.
How in the world did all those people, I mean, Kansas is Kansas, but how did all those people end up there? Was it a matter of people who wanted to work for Larry Brown? Was he really good at spotting talent? How could you get that many people with that kind of pedigree in one spot?
I think, Jim, it was all about trying to work for Larry. You know, everyone so respected him, and, you know, I still think he's as good a coach as I've ever been around in my life from the standpoint of in-game adjustments, getting the most out of his players. He's just a terrific guy, and I've always wanted to. I've known Larry since I was 16, and my goal was to always try to work for him at some stage because I thought I could learn as much as I could ever need to be a head coach.
Yeah, Alvin, was he a great, great coach, or was he maybe even a better teacher than he was a coach?
I think he was a great coach. I think he was a tremendous teacher. You know, I think he was. That was his strong suit, I thought. of teaching guys and getting the most out of the players that he had. So I just think he's, you know, the things that he's done with teams, and even that Philly team that went to the finals that ended up losing to the Lakers, you know, had Iverson, and then they had a, you know, a bunch of guys that were pretty good role players that he made play at such a high level.
Before I let you go, you mentioned Larry Brown and AI. What an amazing relationship that was. You know, it always seemed to me that if you were going to have success for any extended period of time in the NBA, I mean, you don't want to acquiesce to your star players, but if you don't get along with your star players, it's going to be a tough time because in a lot of ways, it's a player's league, or at least you don't win without talent. What about Larry and AI, and Larry with really strong personalities? How did he make that work at that time? Was he strong in that regard too?
Well, I think he was really strong in that regard, and I think if you ask AI now, he'd be the first to tell you that he didn't realize what Larry was trying to do for him at the time, but he very much appreciates it now.
Alvin Gentry, my guest. One last thought from the outside. Looking at your team right now, it seems like the offense is really clicking. You're top five in scoring and assists per game. So how would you describe the chemistry and the identity of the team on the offensive end right now?
Well, I think what we have is we have two great big players, and they're willing passers. They can play inside and outside. And so they realize what they have to do to help this team win, and they're willing to do it. And that's why I think right now Drew Holiday and Etuan Moore is playing at such a high, high level.
That's it for now, clones. This week is flying, and we've got one more show for you to do. Don't forget, TGIF, The Grind, includes Friday. So R.I.P. A.I.M. R.I.P. Doc Dave. Check back here tomorrow. We'll see you then. I'm out.